This week on Making Contact.
I did not believe that we would ever be living in our travel trailer.
We had to always constantly begin begging people to rent us spaces, and when we didn't have any more money to rent places, we began squatting.
Across the U.S., virtually everyone is feeling the deepening economic crunch in one way or another. Unemployment rates are soaring, and homelessness is skyrocketing as the economy continues to sink. Millions of Americans are in dire straits, and stories of trying to survive the times are all too common.
On this edition, we visit a family who lost their home and now lives inside their cramped trailer in a city parking lot. And we'll hear how two different communities are dealing with the economic crisis by taking matters into their own hands. I'm Andrew Stelzer.
And I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
It's said people who are homeless are the poorest of the poor. More than 840,000 adults and children in the U.S. are reportedly homeless in a given week. In a year, there are as many as 3.5 million. And now, with the economy plummeting, homelessness is on the rise. American families once considered middle income are now homeless, losing their houses to foreclosure and their jobs in widespread layoffs. Families who had roofs over their heads now find themselves waking up each morning in an unlikely place, their cars. Making Contact's executive producer, Tina Rubio, spent the day with one such family in the wealthy seaside community of Santa Barbara, California. The day starts with breakfast.
It's 7:30 in the morning, and I'm spending the day with David Clements, his wife Jennifer, and their four kids, who range in age from 8 to 16. Chloe, Yanni, Enya, and Carol Ann, also known as Buzz.
We bought this trailer in 2001, I believe.
That's 43-year-old David.
Yeah, and it sat in our driveway in Ojai for 5 years. And basically just used the trailer for when people or family members came over to visit. They had their own place to retreat to. They had a bed and whatever, you know, all the amenities of home without being underfoot in the house.
But now, this 30-foot trailer parked in a city lot in Santa Barbara is home. The trailer is a cramped space with only one real bed. There is a tiny bathroom, but no running water. Toys, books, and clothes are tucked away best they can. It's kind of an organized chaos, complete with two dogs and two kittens.
I did not believe that we would ever be living in our travel trailer. I thank God that we have it, because we tried to sell it and get rid of it because we needed the money to help pay for bills and whatnot, but God had other plans for us.
David and Jennifer get the kids started on their chores. Everyone pitches in to keep the space tidy.
Get in the bathroom. Get that cleaned up. Get the mirrors cleaned up.
Mirrors? There's only one mirror.
Yeah, but you need to use it with water, not whatever you're using, because you can't see something that's all smoky like or something.
Jennifer wanted David to speak for the family in this story. So as he finishes up the dishes, he tells me that 2 years ago they were renting a house. But after 5 years of living there, the owners decided to sell.
Santa Barbara was voted number four out of 10 most expensive cities in the United States to live in. A two-bedroom apartment rents for $2,300. So you figure first, last, I mean, you're talking $5,000-$6,000 just to find a place to call home.
And they just didn't have that kind of money. It never occurred to the Clements to leave Santa Barbara and find another area to live in. After all, this is their home. And both David and Jennifer still had steady work. He was working as an independent contractor, and Jennifer was a personal fitness trainer. But like so many others, they were hit hard by the downturn in the economy.
We were having some hard times, and Jennifer told me that if she ever had to move into and live in the trailer, that she would divorce me and take me for everything I have. And she's had to eat a lot of crow, humble pie over that one, because it's been 2 years.
Jennifer's personal fitness business tapered off, so did David's contracting jobs. The couple started living off credit cards and their debt went through the roof.
I applied for a job through Craigslist for a glass company, and the gentleman told me that he had to schedule the interviews a week out because he was getting so many emails and phone calls. He was just overflooded with people looking for work. He told me that he ran the same ad 2 months ago and didn't get anybody. So if you're not first in line, you're not going to get a job. And that's even for day work, you know, helping somebody move or hauling. And if you're not right on it, you're not going to work.
It's 3 in the afternoon now. The kids, who are homeschooled by Jennifer, are at the library. And David and I are at Santa Barbara's National Food Bank. David helps out Nancy Kapp every week.
I just got to see what I can put in the lunches.
Well, this one. There's a bunch of them in there.
Nancy is the homeless outreach coordinator for the New Beginnings Counseling Center, a small nonprofit that reaches out to those in need.
Yeah,
you can feel?
Yeah, it's $5.
$5? Oh, yeah, those are too big. How about, what's this?
We're inside a large warehouse. Bread, produce, and beverages line the scaffolding-like shelves. I'm told the food is donated daily by local retail stores and growers.
If I get some of these, you guys can use some, right? Because I use them for the outreach, too. What we do every Friday is we make sandwiches and go feed everybody on State Street and stuff. We make lunches and stuff.
Nancy says in the past months, the group has seen the homelessness in Santa Barbara swell. Seniors, women, middle and lower income families, people who had jobs and now don't, people who had a place to call home, all out on the streets and all needing help.
Basically, we walk up and down State Street, the library, there's a lot of homeless people all over, and we just, you know, ask if they want a lunch, and there are places, another place Casas.
David is all too familiar with the trap that so many are falling into and knows just how valuable food banks have become for people just like him.
You want to take this one? Which one do you want?
I don't care. Whichever one you want, I'll...
Put some of those in here. We can move it around now. I'm sure your kids like muffins, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
David loads the food into Nancy's car, who is heading back to New Beginnings. David takes food for his family, but he has plans for the rest.
The food that I get more than what we need, so my family and I go out and feed the homeless that's in my neighborhood or wherever we happen to be parked. So we got a bunch of hamburgers and vegetables, and so we're going to go feed our little friends of homeless people that we take care of. So give me a hug, you strange woman, you.
Love you.
Thanks for all your help.
You're welcome.
It's now 5:30 in the evening. We're at Plaza Del Mar Park, located across the street from Santa Barbara's Harbor.
Come on, sweetheart. Let's get the kids up here. Make sure they get fed.
Please. I have to feed my kids?
Yeah, I've seen your kids.
No. Give me that plate.
Grassy and shaded by dozens of palm, fig, and flowering trees, the park is anchored by a bright white concrete band shell. In the late afternoon sunlight, people sit stretched out on the grass, watching the concert stage. But tonight, there's no band. Instead, 6 servers take center stage as they scoop spaghetti out onto the plates of about 150 homeless people who've come out for a hot meal. This dinner happens every Wednesday. It's organized by Holy Chaos, a local group which started feeding the homeless just last September. David and his family share bread from the food bank, while others share beverages.
Yeah.
Water.
You want a bag of chips?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Chips?
Oh. So where do you want to sit?
Over by Nancy, I guess.
All right.
As I look around, few, if any, people are eating alone. I ask David about it.
It's community. This is a whole network of people that survive on very little. I mean, I can ask any of these guys for help, and they'll be there in an instant. These people are really loving.
While sitting with the Clements, it's almost hard to remember this family is homeless. But they are. Showers are a luxury at a local YMCA. They brush their teeth in public restrooms. They use food stamps and a local food bank to help feed themselves. Every day is a struggle. It's obvious they're tired. You can see it in their eyes. I asked David what he thought of the homeless before he became one himself.
Basically, I was like everybody else. You know, I'd see somebody homeless, and I'd cross the street or walk around them and not give them money or give them the time of day. We would think, well, just get a job. You know, clean yourself up. You know, don't be a lowlife, or not so much a lowlife, but, you know, there's other ways of living besides being on the street. But when we became homeless, God opened our eyes to a whole new world.
After dinner, David tells Jennifer about a man at the park who could use a blanket, so they walk over to meet him.
This is my wife, Jennifer.
Hi, Jennifer.
This is my daughter, Chloe. This is my one other daughter, Enya. My son, Yanni.
Yanni.
Here, I have a blanket, but you can have the sleeping bag.
God bless you.
Oh, God bless you. Keep warm, huh?
Thank you. All right, man. You just made my day.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Hope we made your night.
Oh, yeah. Thank
Bye.
You.
All right, pass it forward, huh?
It's 10 p.m., and we're back at the city parking lot where the day began. Time for David to hitch the trailer to the van for their nightly move to another parking lot. David and his family participate in Santa Barbara's Safe Parking Program. It's run by the New Beginnings Homeless Outreach Organization, the same group Nancy Kapp works for. New Beginnings worked with the city to open up a dozen or so parking lots across the county to accommodate the growing number of middle-income homeless forced to sleep in their cars on city streets, something that's illegal in Santa Barbara. This is the family's routine, constantly in motion, never completely rooted, never entirely at peace. As we make our way toward the other parking lot, the only home this family knows for now, David shares this story.
3 months ago, we were parked down the street. My youngest daughter, Enya, was playing on the beach. And this jogger came by, and she knocked on the door of the trailer, and she said, "Excuse me, is that your daughter playing out on the beach?" And I said, "Yes, there is. Is there a problem?" And she goes, "No, there isn't, but I just wanted to let you know that there's a lot of riffraff and homeless people living on this beach." And I said, "Oh, thank you very much." And she went on her way, not knowing that I am homeless. I do not fit that profile of homelessness. So she just assumed that I was vacationing. And that, I think, is a lot of people's problem. They just don't realize the person next to them could be homeless that's on the bus.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. We now return to How We Survive, the Deepening Homeless Crisis.
Foreclosures in the U.S. have reached epidemic proportions, with no signs of stopping. Piling on the catastrophic total of lost homes last year, nearly 2.5 million are expected in 2009. And it's no surprise, this is having a devastating impact on working families and those already needing shelter. Next up, Making Contact producer Andrew Stelzer reports from Florida on a Pinellas County pilot project that's providing temporary shelter and services to homeless adults. And we'll also hear how one Miami activist group is taking matters into their own hands, housing homeless people in vacant bank and government-owned homes.
On a dead-end road in a wooded area on the outskirts of St. Petersburg, a lazy Sunday morning is getting underway. Eric Evanauskas is the facilities manager at Pinellas Hope, an experimental homeless village. As we walk past the entrance gate, what appears to be a giant campground unfolds.
We are an outdoor facility. We have two large tents in which the clients dine and watch TV and have their recreation time. We currently have about 200 Coleman outdoor tents, which the clients sleep in at night. These orange and gray tents here. And then we also have to the right here these outdoor houses, which we'll slowly be transitioning the clients into.
Across from the dining tents, there's a row of five wooden structures, nicknamed casitas, or little homes. It would be a major stretch to call them houses, but they provide all the shelter from the elements that a small home would. 8 feet tall and about as big as a queen-size bed, they're a step up from the tents most clients sleep in.
These currently are unoccupied. Are they all locked at the moment? Okay, well, apparently they're all locked, but here you can peek in the window. As you can see inside, they're just secured to the ground with ties, and then they're plywood. They have a shingle roof and four windows for adequate ventilation.
The casitas are as simple as it gets. In fact, the entire compound is bare bones. But it feels more like group living than a shelter. And that's what makes Pinellas Hope so popular with clients like Rocco Mariano, who's been on the streets on and off for the past 5 years.
When I leave here, like, you know, to go to the store, I feel unsafe outside that gate. But when I come here, I say home, sweet home.
The project grew out of a struggle which began in 2006. With the homeless population far surpassing the number of available shelter beds, several unsanctioned tent cities sprung up in downtown St. Petersburg. Then, in early 2007, local police raided those camps, using knives to slash open and destroy people's tents. The ensuing outcry from the public and the media convinced local leaders that while the community might not be overly sympathetic to the homeless, they did want respectful and humane solutions.
And we opened up another tent city contained in a fence. But that was very different. We didn't run it. We took them in and moved them out very, very quickly.
Sheila Lopez is the chief operating officer of the local Catholic Charities and the director of Pinellas Hope.
This gives them more of an opportunity to really get on their feet, save their money, and go. It's a little different concept.
It's hard to measure success, but Lopez says she thinks it's working well. Her most important feedback is what the residents tell her.
I came here from living under a bridge. I will only be here 4 weeks this coming Thursday, and already my life has turned around completely. I never thought that seeing dirt and living in a 10-by-10-foot tent would be heaven.
After moving into Pinellas Hope, Laura Leziati lined up a job working security for the 2009 Super Bowl in nearby Tampa. Pinellas Hope has its own shuttle bus, running 14 hours a day to get residents to and from their jobs and other appointments.
It's not like we're in jail, but you all have to be accountable, and that helps me be accountable to me.
Drugs and alcohol are forbidden here, and there are several AA meetings every week. Residents can also be drug tested and breathalyzed when they come home. But the rules are not absolute, and Lopez says they've experimented a bit with self-governance.
When I was having an alcohol problem in the camp, I brought it to their attention, and they voted and set off the island.
Participation in decisions and in daily life is key to making the residents here feel a sense of both community and responsibility.
So this is our kitchen. As you can see, our clients are busily chopping away for lunch.
Whenever possible, work is done by the residents.
And that's part of the community feeling here. Anytime something needs to be done, more often than not, we have someone here who specialized in that before they became homeless. They can fix a dryer, or they can service the air conditioning system. They can do that sort of thing. And then here's our laundry room. You can go in first if you'd like.
In the laundry room, there are computers for checking email and searching for jobs. Originally funded for just 5 months, local governments decided Pinellas Hope was too valuable a project to lose. So several cities and the county chipped in to keep it running through October 2009. It costs about $3 million a year, but compared to most other shelters, that's cheap. Because of the basic living conditions, the camp only costs about $24 a day a person.
I've had people that tell me that this isn't human, that how can you put people in tents? It's a heck of a lot better than on the street, and it's a heck of a lot better than being hurt or raped. And that's been happening a lot lately.
A lot.
All camping all the time.
If I asked you, you'd stay in that tent, wouldn't you?
No.
Would you rather go to a house with 17 people in it?
Oh, no. I'd rather be in this tent at nighttime.
All right, you got it.
Pinellas Hope served more than 900 clients in its first 12 months.
It gives your morals back, a sense of you're not homeless, really.
James Stockstill has been at Pinellas Hope for 3 months so far. He's looking for a job, hopefully as a painter.
This gives you an incentive to get back on your feet, continue with life like most of us want. To get back that apartment, get back that car, that job, that 40 hours a week. And this place gives you that chance. As to where when you're on the street, it's struggle. You don't struggle here.
There are even more ambitious plans to build 80 individual one-bedroom efficiencies on the back of the property to be used as more long-term housing. But Pinellas Hope isn't designed to be a permanent home, and Lopez says many of the jobs residents are able to get these days are temporary, like collecting money for the Salvation Army or selling T-shirts outside Tampa Bay Bucks football games. While that's a welcome source of income and a step in the right direction, Lopez doesn't consider those real jobs.
Nobody's hiring. They're laying off. Even people that we've placed and were successful are now coming back because they've lost their jobs.
Interested officials and advocates have visited St. Petersburg from all over the country. But the wheels of bureaucracy turn slow. So how to cope when people need help now and the government isn't ready to respond? 5 hours south of St. Pete, Miami is in its own housing crisis. In November of 2008 alone, there were more than 6,000 foreclosures. What do you do with all those empty houses? Well, one local activist decided that an unoccupied home is a waste of a valuable resource.
Okay, so we are driving down 15th Avenue in Liberty City, which used to be a very bustling street, but now is pretty empty.
Driving through the streets of this North Miami neighborhood, Max Rameau points out one of the 8 homes his group has taken over in the past year.
This house here is a few years old, and it's owned by Miami-Dade County. And as far as we've been able to tell, no one has ever legally lived here, but we've moved 2 families into here, including the one that's staying in there now. But so that one is not a foreclosure, it was a government-owned. It's actually owned by the county.
What's the county supposedly doing with it?
They're supposedly leaving it empty in the middle of a housing crisis. People are begging for housing, and they have houses that are empty for years on end.
Frustrated at the sight of those empty houses, Rameau formed a group called Take Back the Land. They find vacant houses, either owned by the government or a bank, fix them up, and move families in. He calls it liberating homes.
So right now we have all around our community vacant homes. There's no one living in them. They're empty. And we have homeless people living on the street. So we started to engage in the process of matching homeless people with peopleless homes.
Marie-Nadine Pierre is one of the formerly homeless working with Take Back the Land.
That's one room. And that's another room. It has a really good closet, a bathroom, and another room. I've never lived in a place like this before. Like, that was mine.
It's a 3-bedroom, 1,400-square-foot home with a huge backyard.
It's running water for sure. See? And I just took a shower. Everything works. And it flushes everything. Sorry, I just took a shower and the tub is having a hard time. I have to fix that. But everything works. It's perfect.
This house was foreclosed on in 2007 and had been sitting vacant since. Pierre and her 18-month-old daughter were moved in November of 2008. While there have always been squatters in cities across the country, what makes Take Back the Land unique is that it's an organized effort, and it's more or less done out in the open. Pierre says her new neighbors are happy she's here.
Oh yeah, I've said hi to the people across. There's an older man who's lived here since 59. He says to me that he's gonna treat me like his daughter. He sent over his nephew. So I've been very happy because people seem relatively friendly. It's a very quiet neighborhood. There's a lot of people on bikes, which I like.
In many ways, it's safer for everyone to have the house occupied, as vacant homes often get broken into and stripped of appliances and copper wiring. Rameau makes sure to inform at least some of the neighbors about what's going on, and he says there have been no problems.
The same banks who own these vacant houses, who own these houses and are keeping them vacant, are getting billions of dollars of taxpayer money as bailouts. So we're actually paying them to keep houses empty and keep people homeless. And I don't think that makes much sense. And I think most people in the community don't think that makes much sense either. So we have wide support for that. And of course, I think there's a lot of people who are concerned that they're going to be in a similar situation soon and therefore have some level of empathy with the families who are moving into these vacant units.
Ironically, this house is owned by Aurora Loan Services, a subsidiary of Lehman Brothers, the now infamous holdings firm that went bankrupt and sparked the global economic collapse. Rameau says he hopes that the current financial and housing crisis will lead society to reevaluate its entire philosophy about private property.
We're asserting that our right to housing supersedes someone else's right to profit, and therefore we have a greater right to vacant homes than a bank who's getting billions of dollars of government bailout money does.
It's a philosophy that's most certainly not in line with the law, but so far there haven't been any legal problems. City of Miami spokesperson Kelly Penton says she's concerned about the safety of abandoned houses, but the city won't get involved unless they're called by the property's owner.
If and when we do encounter people who are squatting on these properties, you know, hopefully the city will be able to work with them to connect them with programs that can assist them to find a permanent solution to their problem, which is the housing problem.
Take Back the Land's participants leave if they're asked to by the property's owners. Marie-Nadine Pierre knows that day will eventually come, but in the meantime, she's just happy to not be in a shelter. Pierre and her husband bought a home in 1997, but lost it 6 years later due to foreclosure. Since then, she's been struggling to survive.
There's no jobs. And, you know, 10% of the black population in areas like Liberty City are unemployed or underemployed. Even when I could get jobs, I was underemployed. When I owned my house, I used to have four jobs at one point. Four jobs!
Although she's scared to be living in an illegal situation, Pierre says she didn't have much choice.
I'm not saying I want to stay rent-free, but if it was given to me at a correct price and I could afford the monthly payments, like that was affordable, that's supposed to be 30% of somebody's salary of what you earn, I'd pay it.
Rameau says Take Back the Land has been getting calls of interest from around the country, and other similar projects are popping up. In Atlanta, some homeowners are paying the homeless to sleep in and guard their properties from burglars. And advocates in Cleveland are hoping the city will allow the homeless to fix up some of the more than 12,000 abandoned homes around town and stay in them during the renovation process. Rameau says he's not surprised.
This is happening because people are desperate. And there's a extreme number of vacant and empty houses. And there's no reason why people shouldn't be in those homes. So I think what's going to happen is we're going to see a big social discussion about what the meaning of land ownership is, what the meaning of private ownership is, and what the meaning of housing is. And is housing a right or is it a privilege? And what are the reasonable amounts that people should have to pay for such a privilege? And or should people not have to pay for it at all?
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. For a CD copy of this program, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Andrew Stelzer producer, Con Pham associate director, Elena Bakken-Levy production coordinator, and Asma Mosseini, Patty Restaino, and Rita Daniels interns. And I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.